Welcome to Total Network Operations, the project with a podcast dedicated to hardworking network operators like you who light up the fibers and deliver all the packets. Here on TNOPS, we shine a bright light on great ideas in NetOps so you can take away useful ideas to make informed decisions for your own network and your team. I'm your friendly internet plumber, Scott Robon. Today, we're going to do a dive into the evolution of high-speed pluggable cable assemblies in this sponsored episode with the Siemens Company. When it comes to network cabling, more is better. Speed matters. We've all seen the evolution of links from slow serial links and 64 kilobit per second ISDNB channels to shared Ethernet, 10 and 100 meg Ethernet, then switched Ethernet. And as Ethernet continued to evolve, it leaped from the LAN to the WAN as well, going from 1 gig connections to 10 gig, 25 gig, 100 gig, 400 gig rolling out today with 800 coming soon to a data center near you, and 1.6 terabit per second Ethernet connections not far away. Ethernet has just been this adaptable animal, and it continues to evolve. And don't forget InfiniBand. Like it or not, you're going to hear more about that too. This rocket ride of increasing speeds requires serious innovation in cabling. You know, the stuff you like to forget in OSI layers one and two. You know, my favorite mnemonic for that is people don't need these stupid protocols anyway. You can do the decode. You know the seven layers. We're talking about physical and data link layer issues here. You might want to set it and forget it, but you really need a refresher on what's happening in the physical and data link layers. The physics of getting to faster speeds impacts cabling, form factors, flexibility, power, connectors, and more. This is becoming even more critical in data centers where we're cramming more and more compute, CPUs, DPUs, GPUs, and more network plumbing to connect it all. Things are changing fast. And to help us understand the nuts and bolts with modern cabling technology, today we have our good friend and co-host Ethan Banks and Ryan Harris, the sales and market manager for high-speed cable assemblies at the Siemens Company. Ryan's here to talk about how they see this evolving and the set of cabling issues and the solutions they bring to the market. Ryan, welcome. It's great to have you here on TNOPS today.
Hey, glad to be here.
Cool. Tell us about the Siemens Company, what you do, what your customers look like, and how you serve those customers. Give us a feel for all that.
Well, I'm a sales engineer at the Siemens Company, and I've been supporting high-speed cable assemblies for approximately 15 years. Interesting fact about the Siemens Company is it's over 100 years old. Back in the early 1900s, they were supporting AT&T with terminal blocks.
Wow.
And the reason why AT&T liked the Siemens Company terminal blocks is because of the resin. They just didn't break.
Interesting.
And yeah. Today, the Siemens Company, fast forward, is still in the telecommunications space, also supporting smart buildings. And then also data centers.
And we'll focus a lot on data center today too. But yeah, I took a look at all your corporate material. You're into many other application areas as well.
Yeah, and it's primarily cabling and then cabling management.
Got it. How did you get interested in this as a career? You know, what took you down this path?
So early in the 2000s. SFP Plus and QSFP Plus 40 gigs were the fastest speeds and the most interesting, you know, emerging technologies. And so I was in the early days, and it's just continued to evolve. And along that way, it's just, you know, been more complex, and it's kept it interesting and has also kept me relevant. So, you know, I was in the early days.
This is such an interesting blend of like the real practicality of just getting cable connections to work for network equipment, but the physics is not trivial. And don't worry, we're not going to do a deep dive on the physics of coding schemes, although I know you're going to want to talk about that a little bit. But there's like real engineering and real science that goes into signal propagation. It's something that I don't know nearly as much as I want to know about, but it's always kind of fascinated me. So that's a very cool start. Can you summarize? Let's start off by talking about high-speed cable assemblies. What do you mean when we use that term? And how did we get from, you know, your early days of we know how to plug a single Ethernet cable in from one point to another, a single pair of fiber from one to another. But how has that changed and evolved over time?
Well, it started, like I said, with 10 gig, and now it's gone all the way out to 800 gig. And the way that we get there is there's six different connectors, and the connectors can support lanes from one lane all the way out to eight lanes. In addition to there being more connector types, there's also more speed per lanes options. So 10 gigs per lane all the way out to 100 gigs per lane. And that's how we achieve, 800 gig speeds. It's an eight lane connector at 100 gigs per lane.
So let's dive into that a little bit. So if we go back to 10 gig, let's use this as an example to talk about what a lane is and how you use, multiple parallel lanes to get those high speeds. Were those 10 gig connections just a single lane? And can you explain what you mean by a lane?
Okay, yes. So the 10 gig SFP was a single lane connector that's still being used today. And it's just one lane of 10 gig for SFP. And then there's SFP 28, which is a one lane of 25 gig. There's SFP 56, which is one lane of 50 gig. SFP 112, again, one lane of 100 gigs. And then there's also QSFPs, which is quad small form factor pluggable. Quad means four lanes. And so it could be 4x10, which would be 40 gigs, or 4x25, which would be 100 gigs, and so on. And then there's all the way out to eight lane connectors like the QSFP double density, which is eight lanes. And it can be any combination of 50 gig per lane, which would be 400 gig, or 100 gig per lane, which could be 800 gig.
So why lanes though? So why, in other words, we got 100 gig lanes now. Does that mean I no longer need my 25x4 to get 100 gig option that I might have had? It's like all these different ways to get to 100 gig.
That is correct. And that's why I was saying that it's getting more complex. So whatever, you want to deploy, it can be done. So there's breakouts that can be 4x25. There's also straight 100 gigs per lane, and there's a variety of options, connecting a legacy network equipment that might be running 25 gigs per lane to, higher speed switches that are 100 gigs per lane.
Well, so is the reason I pick one versus the other because of breakout, where I might, like you said, I might have a server that's 25 gig uplink and I'm going to take a 100 gig assembly, but it's a four by 25 lane option that I can do a breakout cable to connect up servers. Is that why I would choose that versus, point to point switch to, spine to core or something like that?
So the cables that I support, the direct attached copper and also the active optical cables, are primarily in switch to server. And so it really depends on your application. Are you supporting lots of requests per second, or are you doing some, AI processing? And that really determines what speed you're going to use. And then also whatever, network equipment you're comfortable with, or, you plan on adding as an upgrade. And so it's really up to the customer, and it's primarily has to do with their application. But, there's lots of options. The cables, connectors are whatever the customer wants to connect.
You're saying it's really driven by the equipment I have then, as opposed to...
Yes, driven by the equipment, yes.
A multi-lane version of 100 gig isn't better or worse than a single lane 100 gig. It just depends on what it is I'm trying to plug in.
Oh yeah, it depends on density, like how many connections are you trying to make, right? So breakouts are really good for utilizing a switch to increase density. So if you do one-to-one, you have, less connections that you can make, versus a breakout. If you're doing a 100 gig breakout, you're connecting to potentially four different devices below it. And that's just a way of, utilizing a switch better is having a breakout to support density.
So let's just do a little quick compare and contrast of point to point versus point to multipoint, the breakout scenario. If I'm doing point to point, like it's a switch to switch connection, 100 gig link or a 400 gig link, those lanes are not exposed to the switch, right? The switch ports don't know how many lanes and what type they are, within the link, right? It just looks like a 100 gig link or a 400 gig link to me, correct?
No, that's actually incorrect.
Okay.
You have to set up the port on the switch to whatever mode you want it. Is it a one-to-one mode? Is it a one-to-four mode? So it's a part of the, you know, the configuration of the port. These cable assemblies are actually smart. They have an EEPROM map inside of them, which actually says what it's capable of doing. And the switch can read the cable and then set the port appropriately.
Okay. And that's what you, how you would get the breakout capability, right? If I'm attaching to four servers on the single port, you'd set the mode to that breakout mode. And then I'd probably have like sub interfaces associated with each host connection.
Yeah. So it depends on the connector of the switch or the network equipment. So the switch, for example, a QSFP switch, you know, the QSFP again is four lanes. So because of that connector, is capable of doing four lanes, you can configure the port setting to break out to four lanes, for example. Then if you're using an OSFP connector, for example, which is eight lanes, you have possibilities to break out 2x, 4x, and in some applications, 8x.
So talk about how you engage with your customers on this. Like, there are lots of options that, just like a certain host didn't completely understand, and you helped him understand, you know, how things work and how things need to be configured. What does that look like for you on a day-to-day basis?
So I work with network teams, and usually when I get involved, they already know what network equipment they're going to connect. And so I'll ask them, you know, what are you connecting on both ends? And then I'll look up the data sheets and see what connectivity is possible. And I'll review the options, whether it's DAC, if they're trying to make connections up to 5 meters or below 5 meters, or active copper or active optical, if they're trying to, you know, get extended reaches beyond 5 meters.
Okay. So this is a good place to, like, let's do some more term definition, right? Like, we've talked about, I think we dropped the term structured cabling. You just used DAC. We introduced AOC. Can you take us through each one of those?
So a DAC is a direct attached passive copper cable, and it's made for connections, switch to switch, switch to server, Ethernet or InfiniBand, short reach connections, 5 meters and below.
It's and those, the lowest those power. The assemblies, they've got the pluggables on either end and a big piece of copper that goes in between them. I don't have to supply a cable. It's all one big assembly.
That's correct. Just a plug and play cable assembly that goes inside of a, you know, an SFP port.
And before I cut you off, you were talking about power. What's the power utilization on a DAC?
Oh, so the DAC, some of the advantages of DAC is it's the lowest power option. So it's passive. It's just basically a copper jumper cable. And then at the AOC is active, and it has, you know, a chip and some lasers that change the signal from copper to optical on the other end, and optical back to copper. But that has requires power draw. And so the DAC is passive. It doesn't require any power. And the AOCs with their active chips do.
I think AOC, like the simple
as an active optical cable.
Yeah.
Got it.
And because of that, they're higher heat as well.
Yeah.
The power, you know, generates some heat. And they're also more expensive. So usually my customers, they like to consider, you know, copper where they can, again, primarily on length. And density as well.
So, I mean, the simplest differentiator there is, for a passive copper cable, all I need to do is send a signal across. I don't need to power it separately. Active optical cables have lasers, and those lasers draw power and they create heat.
Right. Yeah, exactly.
So then what's an active copper cable?
So that's an interesting question. So at these higher speeds, to make sure that the signal performance is carried through, larger cable diameters are used. And then at 800 gig, passive copper has a length limitation around 2 to 3 meters. Mm. But, you know, people are used to using these cables out to 5 meters. And so active copper is used to reduce the cable diameter and maintain maintain the signal health, and then also reach lengths out to 5 meters at the higher speeds.
So 5 meters in a big data center seems like a really big limitation. And so can you talk about how you guide customers through copper versus optical choices and flavors of each, and also, you know, the impact on density, power, and just, you know, having to cram a lot of cable.
Good question.
For it.
So the DACs are typically used within a cabinet. So, and cabinets are, you know, usually like 42U cabinet is 2.5 meters from top to bottom. So 3 meters can achieve interact connection. But I am seeing some customers that are interested in using copper outside the cabinet, and 5 meters can support, you know, two cabinets adjacent to wherever that initial connection is. Beyond that, they're going to want to use AOCs. Also, I was talking about copper cables having a thicker cable diameter to support, you know, higher speeds. That's another area where if there's high density, somebody or a customer might be interested in exploring AOCs or optics to reduce the cable diameter. But there's trade-offs, like I said, the power trade-offs, cost trade-offs as well. And so
It's a funny balance with that. I've been in situations where you get enough copper in the cabinet, you're actually blocking airflow. Just trying to manage all that cable, it can be tricky, especially if the cabinet was poorly planned. I have scars, Ryan. I have scars.
Your trauma. You're revealing your trauma. I get it.
But then a lot of data centers, most data centers, right, have done some kind of fiber plant where they've got fiber distributed through MDFs and IDFs and whatever the scheme is to deliver fiber most of the places you need it. And it's just a matter of, well, when do we stop using fiber, start using copper, and so on. When you're talking about customers who are trying to reduce that cable diameter within a cabinet because it's just too much physical cable, they're actually using all fiber? Is that possible, like end-to-end, some customers?
Yeah, some customers are using all fiber within the cabinet. And it's typically because of high density and making sure that the cable, you know, doesn't obstruct airflow, like you were saying.
I can see that with a bunch of 1U servers that have multiple network interfaces that they got to link up and so on. And then all of a sudden, the count's really high.
But copper cables have been evolving over time. So, for example, we have a flexible cable design that is a little different than what's been used in the past for higher density. And it's basically to help make sure that when we're supporting, you know, 8-lane connectors, they're actually able to bend the cable and make routes from top to bottom or from side to side.
So what else goes into like your input on making sure there's appropriate airflow, planning for the future? You know, but you're not upgrading the cabling in your data center, your facility every year or every couple of years. What do refresh cycles look like? Talk about that.
So again, these point-to-point cables are typically used in switch to server. And switch to server is the lifespan is typically 3 to 5 years. And sure. So there's a refresh every 3 to 5 years. And again, the cables are typically inner cabinet, and there are some adjacent cabinet connections on both DACs and AOCs. But these cables are typically replaced when the network equipment is upgraded. They're typically upgrading to a higher speed. So the cables, you know, if they don't support the higher speed, they just replace them.
So does that put you in an interesting situation in terms of like every 3 years, if I haven't touched this, like from a technology perspective, you come in as an expert to help people understand, okay, here's how it works. And by the way, here's the new stuff that you didn't have available to you 3, 4, 5 years ago. That's got to be interesting for you. The keeping the new innovations gives you more to talk about each time you engage.
Yeah, so I usually want to hear about what they're deploying today, and I give them the options of what they can use in the cable assemblies. But then also, you know, they like to, the customers like to hear about what's upcoming as well. And so I give a roadmap overview so that way they can do planning on their end. But I usually, you know, again, customers already know what network equipment that they're planning on deploying. And I come in and review options. But some network teams, they haven't, you know, they do the deployments every 3 to 5 years. And on the front end, they're, when they get the cable, they're trying to make their first connection. And so I can help if the customer is plugging in a cable and say they're unable to make an initial connection. And that's usually where, you know, problems happen, is the initial connection. And so as a sales engineer, I can come in and work with customers and ask them to do a show command so I can see where the configuration is. And typically what I'm looking for is making sure that the ports, you know, configured correctly, for example, breakout mode. And I'm also looking to make sure that things are matched on both ends.
So you just answered that
can cause a problem if things don't match on both ends.
You just answered my next question, is what typically is the problem? Is it like an incompatibility between the cable assembly and the switch, or is it a configuration problem? My guess was configuration challenges, and it sounds like that's mostly what happens.
Oh yeah, before we send or launch cables or even send them to customers, we've done testing. We know that they work. And so it's just, you know, walking the customer through, making sure that they configure it properly. It doesn't typically happen, but when it does, we want to help make sure that the customer is able to make a connection.
Well, from all our experience in switch and router configuration, auto negotiation always works and is 100% reliable, right?
Okay.
works until it doesn't. Right. And we had a great conversation when we talked before about this, right? You know, there's times where you've got a hard code, you know, certain, you know, port configuration issues to see, is there an auto negotiation problem happening?
Yeah. Auto negotiation is different vendor to vendor. That's what I've seen. It doesn't always work the same. And so if something's not negotiating the way that you would expect, that's when we go in and try to figure out what's happening and what specifically doesn't match.
So you probably have to have a pretty broad palette of understanding switch config options across multiple vendors.
Yeah. So port config. Configuration yeah. options.
Do you
typically Ethernet? So that's what we right. work in
sure.
the most.
Yeah. How do you like? How many switch port configuration config vendors would you say you're good with? You don't need to name names. But
I'm pretty good within the Ethernet ecosystem. All of the top, players, Cisco, Arista. Juniper, NVIDIA, and so on, Dell as well. But it's all industry standard. So they all are typically, you know, follow the same standards, Ethernet 802.3 and so on. Right. And they should all work and interop, you know, the same, but every once in a while, like I said, there are some things that don't negotiate the way you expect them to.
So you mentioned NVIDIA. Let's park there for a little bit. You know, they have Ethernet solutions and InfiniBand solutions. You see deployments with your structured cabling for both their Ethernet and InfiniBand deployments.
For structured cabling, we do, yes. And yeah. for structured cabling, it's typically just passive. Fiber optics, but when we get into the point-to-point cables that I'm talking about, Ethernet is an open ecosystem, so they work. On the InfiniBand side, NVIDIA is the industry leader, and typically customers, if they're using the latest and greatest speeds, 800 gig or 1.6 terabytes. They usually, you know, use the vendor cables. Again, it's a small ecosystem where NVIDIA is the primary vendor. But there are some situations where, you know, NVIDIA has long lead times. And, you know, once customers get the network equipment, they don't want to wait for cables. And that's where we come in to save the day.
Very good. Now, you talked about where certain pieces of your product portfolio are manufactured. How do you achieve better lead times? You've got some North American manufacturing, and what other locations?
You know, we have North American manufacturing. We also have manufacturing in Asia. We're a global company, and so we try to manufacture and also have supply hubs globally to support wherever our customers are at. In North America, we build our copper cables to order and whatever length that they want, whatever, you know, combination they want. And we do it pretty quickly, and we offer a lot of options as well in lengths and also colors. But, you know, nobody wants to wait for a cable. And so we want to make sure that the manufacturing is close to where the customer need is at. So that way we can build it and then ship it to order.
Well, that's, I'm funny guessing, you said colors.
Yeah.
I was going there too. Manager. Yep. I worked with a data center manager for whom colors were a thing. If it was inside a rack, it all had to be blue. That was the thing. And if it wasn't blue,
blue's popular here.
Oh man. I remember sitting at my desk one morning. He went out into the data center because he would do a patrol. And he'd walk up and down the racks and so on. It was a decent size, but walkable data center. And he came back to my desk and said, "Who's got the yellow cable in, you know, whatever the rack was?" I'm like, "Oh, that was Dave or whoever it was. He was working on a thing." He's like, "Well, you tell him when he gets in that I'm going to take my snippers and snip that cable half until he gets a blue cable in there." Cable thing. It's funny that you just say colors because it really does matter to some people.
Yeah. Typically, you know, we offer colors. And it's whatever the customer wants to do. If they want to distinguish, you know, primary versus a secondary network, you know, so I see colors being used for that. Also classification of whatever the port is being used for. And you know, those are the primary reasons people use colors. Also, there's lots of different speed options. And I've seen customers that want to, you know, make their 25 gig cables a different color than their 10 gig cables if they're within, you know, the same cabinet or even close to a cabinet. They want to be able to distinguish it because they all look the same, right?
Yeah.
The cables, so you can't tell what speed is just by looking at the cable.
For what it's worth, I've been in different shops that had different schemes like that, and it always got to be a little too hard, and after a while the color scheme would devolve a bit unless you had someone that was very rigorously enforcing the color scheme. But
right,
yeah. Now Ryan you mentioned customers, and you've got manufacturing hubs and distribution hubs and so on all around the world. Who are your customers? Who's buying from you? Are these just resellers or integrators, or are you dealing with end customers too?
Oh yeah. So our primary focus is end users, and then also cloud service providers. We also support hyperscale customers as well. So, you know, we have a global sales team, and there's, you know, lots of different applications that we support, or lots of different verticals. You know, financial institutions, healthcare, universities, research, and so on. And you know, so it's a end user focus with what I was just describing. But then we also work with integrators that help deploy systems for end users as well.
And when you say integrators, are they like data center integration firms, or can you describe them a little further?
The integrators I work with are system integrators, again, switch to server, where they're helping a customer deploy a top of rack cabinet where everything is cabled ahead of time and they ship it, you know, basically plug and play ready to the infrastructure when it arrives.
Got it. Okay. Just to circle back on copper versus fiber, you know, we know there are advantages and disadvantages, right? Copper, especially passive connections, have got to be less expensive, right?
Yes.
What rough cost differential am I looking at on a copper versus fiber installation?
It really depends on speed, you know. So as a general number, it's typically, you know, 5x, you know, passive copper to active optical. But then also, you know, now there's active copper. When you add that active copper chip into it, it reduces the savings, but it's still lower than active optical.
Ryan, are most of your customers really savvy about those cost calculations?
They know generally that, or expect copper to be less than optical.
But it's not just the CapEx. I mean, there's the OpEx expense too, because of the additional power draw. You got to have bigger power budget depending on the port density you're dealing with and so on. Do you find that the majority of your customers are actually thinking along those terms, playing the long game?
Most recently, they've started thinking about that. And the OpEx savings, you know, does add up in volume. But what I'm seeing now is at these higher speeds, they're worried about power because of heat. And what's happening is that there's these 800 gig, 400 gig switches that are really high density. And when they're plugging in a whole bunch of cables and, you know, active higher power cables into these switches, they start to get concerned about heat. And that's something that, you know, that I'm seeing more and more. Hmm.
Now, does the Siemens company also resell nuclear power plants?
No. That's probably a good business to get into.
Not yet.
Power is definitely a challenge and for the data centers to grow out.
If you were to hazard a guess, and maybe you, if you don't want to speculate, I understand, you know, there's power draw, you know, associated with active optics, and there's heat generated. Do you have any idea for like, okay, what percentage of, you know, the complete power budget for a rack, you know, or even the cooling load that would be required that can come from active optics? Is it only 5%? Is it 10%? Like compared to the heat that, you know, your servers and GPUs are putting off and your network equipment's putting off?
So to answer that question, the way that I look at it is cooling costs. So it's 1-to-1 for every watt of power that you're using. Mm-hmm. For an optic, you use another, you know, watt to cool it.
Okay.
So there's a 1-to-1 there. Mm-hmm. So if you're, you know, deploying thousands of, you know, 4-watt cables, then you can do the math and figure out how many kilowatts you would save by reducing that power.
Right.
Not a silly question. Are you seeing additional, you're seeing more and more data centers adopt water cooling because of the heat density problem?
Oh yeah. So I'm seeing a lot of, for at the higher speeds and with GPUs specifically that draw more power and create more heat than CPUs. I'm seeing liquid to chip cooling inside the servers. I've heard that the switches are going to be going that direction in the future as well, but I haven't seen one deployed yet. But definitely in these GPU servers, they're trying to get more and more density inside the cabinet. And you know, when you have air cooled, the way that you handle heat is that you spread out the heat, right? But they're trying to get more and more density, and the way that they do that is liquid to chip cooling for the servers.
Don't drink that liquid. Don't drink that liquid. That's not water. Yeah.
So I haven't built a data center for some time, Ryan, but back in my days of participating in those sorts of projects, the amount of power that they're pulling into a single densely packed GPU cabinet for AI or whatever the project is might have been a whole row or even a whole data center, just you know, depending on the scale. But it's extraordinary how many kilowatts they're pulling in now and then megawatts at data center scale to supply all this stuff. It's a problem on a completely different scale than it was even 10 years ago.
Yeah, but it's kept it interesting, right? That's
I had a conversation with a data center infrastructure company a couple weeks ago where they're already looking at designs that'll support 500K per rack. You know,
I have not heard that yet.
Yeah, we're already going above 10K. We can see the next gen of NVIDIA gear driving 100K per rack. Mm-hmm. But, you know, they're very power hungry, and we're going to see more and more. So
there is more than one, you know, liquid cooling when we start talking about 500K per cabinet. I haven't heard that yet, but I would assume that would be liquid immersion cooling.
Yeah. Yeah, it would have to be. Those. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yep. Go ahead.
And there are some, you know, challenges with cables when you start talking about liquid immersion cooling. So we're actually working on liquid immersion cooling cable assemblies. You know, the cables work, but what you want to do is you want to make sure that the cable doesn't contaminate the fluid. And so we've been experimenting with different cable jackets just to make sure that they don't, you know, leach into that or contaminate the fluid. And then also that they don't, you know, fall apart inside of the fluid as well.
Yeah. That, so a whole new set of challenges for data center operations and maintenance functions, right? When you have, we have to issue an RMA for a board that's submerged in whatever, I'm sure non-toxic liquid it's submerged in, you know, the swap is not as easy as it used to be. So that's going to be an interesting new set of issues. So,
I agree.
You know, so it's funny, you know, the power conversation and, you know, what the max per rack is going to, we always talk about the bigger numbers before they actually happen. And I think the same is true for Ethernet interconnect speeds. You know, we talked about 100 gig a long time before 100 gig was actually available. Same for 400, same for 800. What's the timeline that you see now? What proportion of your customers are still moving to 100 versus those who are actively moving to 400 and now 800 coming soon? What's that timeline look like?
So 100 gig and 25 gig, it's typically supporting, you know, the front end, you know, lots of requests. But now AI is what's driving these higher speeds, and the adoption of these higher speeds is happening quicker than we expected. So, you know, we were working on 400 gig, and quickly after we launched 400 gig, we realized that we needed 800 gig because, you know, people are launching or were looking at deploying projects sooner than we expected, a lot sooner than, you know, customers adopted 100 gig, for example. AI workloads are driving that demand.
So how long have you had 400 gig cable support?
Since the beginning of last year.
Okay. And then you have 800 gig product today?
And we have 800 gig product that we're deploying this year. It's available, but for marketing purposes, it's going to be this year.
Got it. Yeah, you mentioned there were some new things that are rolling out, and I think you mentioned that 800 gig product is one of them.
Yeah, that's in both copper, active copper, and AOCs.
Interesting. How far out do you think 1.6 terabit links are?
You know, NVIDIA on the InfiniBand side already has it, or they've released it, and it's 200 gigs per lane. Eight lanes.
Yep.
And so Ethernet, I believe, is going to get there as well. You know, the Ethernet standard for 200 gigs per lane is supposed to be launched next year. And so, you know, Ethernet is a fast follower, but InfiniBand already has 1.6 terabytes. But I assume that that's probably going to be, you know, a niche market for hyperscale.
Scott, so I talked to some folks who suggested that 1.6 terabit for Ethernet, late 2026 at best, probably 2027. We'll see. There is a bit of a wait and see thing here for sure.
For sure. Yeah. But it is now 2025. So 2026 is the end of next year, right?
And yeah.
We'll it's going to be here before we know it, in a sense. Ryan, I agree. It'll be niche at first. But you know, things follow. And you know, to your comment about, you know, 1.6 terabit InfiniBand support being out there, you know, it's easier for a single manufacturer to focus and get that delivered versus a whole Ethernet ecosystem, you know, where the Ethernet standards still need to be finished. And then everybody who wants to play in that game spins up manufacturing. But over the long run, I'm playing my opinion card here. I am going to get better cost in the Ethernet solution than I will for the InfiniBand solution, because I can get it from more places. So
that's the benefit of the open ecosystem.
Yeah. Well, we're going to start to wind this down, but I want to make sure I give you the opportunity to talk about any other key technologies, any other key product info you want to talk about before we wind down.
Nothing really comes to mind top of my head, but, you know, really there's lots of different cabling types out there. all the way out to 800 gig, lots of different combinations, straight throughs, breakouts. There's color options as well. There's Ethernet and InfiniBand. And, you know, if any customers are looking to make deployments, you know, we're here to help with, you know, we have the right cable types. And also we have the support to help make sure you can make a connection.
Cool. Yeah, make a connection. No pun intended. Make a connection to make a connection.
That's actually the tagline for the Siemens company is connecting the world to a higher standard.
There you go. I always ask folks, you know, toward the end here, do you have any interesting ops stories? You know, you can hide and obfuscate names. You don't need to get anybody in trouble. But do you have like a famous, in your mind, customer that you really helped clean up their cabling situation? Or, you know, have you ever caused a data center outage by?
Oh man!
I'll leave it up to you. I know I'm surprising you with the question.
That hasn't happened. No, there's lots of redundancy to make sure that doesn't.
There you go. That's a perfect answer. Perfect answer. But yeah. You must have seen some rat's nests for cabling that you've been able to help make better.
Well, yeah. So you know, I've seen where customers are just trying to deploy really quickly. And after, you know, a customer deploys, you know, a lot of cables, I want to go check it out. And so I try to schedule a visit. And, you know, nowadays, you know, with AI, for example, customers are trying to build things out as quickly as possible. And so sometimes cable management is not something that they are worried about. And so, you know, typically, you know, after a large deployment, I'll go there and check it out and, you know, make some suggestions to clean it up just, you know, for airflow, and then, you know, just also just making it more visually appealing. But airflow is really the issue with cable management. Also, you want to, you know, I want to make sure that when I go out there, that there's not any, you know, critical bends happening that could, you know, hurt cable signal health
for sure. Well,
but it's very common. So where you know, cable management isn't top priority.
Yeah. And I've worked, you know, in enough labs, especially as attack engineer, where no, cabling was not our priority. Cable management was not our priority. And being the tallest guy walking down the racks, people would often disrespect me and I'd have to duck all the time. So
they weren't ready for you.
They were not. But Ryan, where can folks find you if they have other questions? Where can they learn more about what you're talking about in terms of cabling solutions from the Siemens company?
Well, our website is very intuitive and it has all the information. So any of the cables that you're looking for, you can just go to the www.siemens.com and you can navigate through there. You know, I'm on LinkedIn. You can reach out to me, you know, on LinkedIn as well. On the website, there's also a chat function, so you can ask questions and also reach out to us through our website there. And the Siemens company is on LinkedIn and other social media platforms. And so whenever customers reach out, we're really good at responding. And we have lots of different platforms to do that on.
Ryan Harris, thank you so much. Ryan Harris on LinkedIn, really appreciate your time today. And we appreciate all of you listening in for tuning into Total Network Operations. We love your feedback, especially on topics you'd like us to cover, people you'd like to hear. If you know someone with important things to say about NetOps, let us know. Please spread the word. Let's get others involved in this conversation. For any other comments, you can drop me a DM on LinkedIn or send follow-up to packetpushers.net/follow-up. Thanks again, and we'll see you next time on TNOPS.